Okay, I have for some time promised to make a study of our doctrinal paper, which is from August 2002, been approved by the Council of Elders. And so time is here to begin it. Now, we have some additional copies here if anybody needs a copy. I don't really anticipate getting into the doctrinal paper today. I'm just going to set the background for some understanding. And as I said to you during the sermon, maybe I belabor the point. I'm the opposite of Mr. Holloway. I belabor the point interminably, as many of you may feel. And maybe sometimes I feel it myself. August 2012 is the date this doctrinal paper was issued. Now, it was approved by the Council of Elders at that time. That's been 12 years ago. And I would note to you that it has been little noticed and not long remembered. At one time, an individual said, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here today." Anybody know who that was? Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg. "The world will little note nor long remember." Well, that's kind of been the fate of this doctrinal paper. I don't think many people noted it, and it hasn't been remembered by very many people. And I was among that group. I have, though, probably 5 or 6 years ago, discovered the paper, which I had not previously discovered, and the paper just comes to a singular conclusion that we have called something differently than it should have been called. So I say, well, so what? If we just got the name a little bit wrong, so what? And I don't think it's just about the name that we call the festival at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles. Because we were calling it the Last Great Day. And there's some Bible scriptures which we were using in the Gospel of John chapter 7 to identify it as the Last Great Day. I think it's clear from this doctrinal paper, we were incorrect about that. So what? Okay, we just correct it. Is it worth spending some time here to maybe go over this and not just see that we're incorrect? I think it is worthy of our time because it makes a lot of implications about other things that we have understood that haven't even been considered in the doctrinal paper. And I'd like to build up to the doctrinal paper, go through the doctrinal paper, and then demonstrate to you some of the things that are implied by what we see in this doctrinal paper. Those things have to do with John chapter 8 and chapter 9. Because if this be true, which I am very convinced it is true, then John chapter 8 and chapter 9 have to be seen in an entirely different light. Why do I say that? Well, because the events of John 8 and John 9 occur on what day? Those events are actually occurring on the eighth day of the festival, the day that we used to call the Last Great Day. And if we look at those events in that light, maybe as being prophetic, because of the day on which they occurred, they could mean something entirely different to us. So that's, so what? Why would I take the time to go over this? It's because of what is implied if our understanding is correct about this, about John chapter 8 and John chapter 9. It didn't change our doctrine at all. The paper here did not change our doctrine at all, did it? It just concludes that we didn't exactly understand the events that were going on in John chapter 7. And as a result of not understanding the events, we called the day by the wrong name. If that's all it is, then okay, I could understand if that's the end of our conclusion, why it was little noted or nor long remembered. But on the other hand, if it is implying something much greater in John chapter 8 and John chapter 9 as a result of our understanding, then maybe it is worthy of spending time on. I'm going to try and These Bible studies to get through this are going to take several Bible study periods. We won't be doing it the next time I'm here in 2 weeks because we'll be doing a speaker seminar at that time. So it'll be 4 weeks before we continue on with it. And I hope you all take it and maybe read it and think about, read it in the light and think about what it may mean in relationship to John chapter 8 and chapter 9. Okay, so what I'm doing here is beginning the Bible study of doctrinal paper, which is this doctrinal paper is a long and complex doctrinal paper with a lot of technical information from rabbis and so forth, and it comes to the singular conclusion that we were calling the day by the wrong name. It doesn't go on from there. I had one question asked to me when I said I was going to do this. Do we really have to know this? Do we really have to know this? Why do we have to know it? And the implication of the question was twofold. Number one, is salvation at stake? Is my salvation at stake if I don't know this and don't understand this completely? And, of course, it isn't. It isn't. We can go back and we look at the Middle Ages, and people had no Bibles. And so what were their chances to know this, you know, to know this? They had only thin information at best. You know, Victor at one time talked about the people in Eastern Europe and in remote areas who had, he called it scraps. That's all they had. They had got maybe some piece of a booklet of the Worldwide Church of God, and they were really, really enamored with what they had had. And they had only scraps of information. We had all of the information. Well, what about the people in the Middle Ages? They didn't even have that. But yet, I'm confident that God has some people throughout all of those ages that He was calling and will be in the kingdom, even though they didn't have that information. So, my conclusion about that is, no, it isn't necessary for salvation. 1930s, what about, I mean, we look at the situation in the 1930s. People did not even generally know about the holy days. And here's what God has to say in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1, about that, to the church at Sardis. And we understand the church eras in the book of Revelation are sequential in time. Now, there's probably multiple understandings of those scriptures, but we, in general, I think this is probably one of the really valid explanations for the seven churches in the book of Revelation, is that they are sequential in time. Ephesus being the first era right after the death of Christ and proceeding all the way down. We're maybe in the sixth or seventh era of the church now, Philadelphia and Laodicea, and maybe some of Sardis as well. A lot of these eras overlap if we look at the if we look at the churches as being arrows. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1, to the angel of the church at Sardis. Bad, I mean, if there's one church in here that has a bad report that we wouldn't want to be like, it's the church at Sardis. To the angel of the church at Sardis, these things says he that has the seven spirits of God, that's his Christ, and the seven stars, I know your works. You have a name that you live, and yet you are dead. So Christ speaking here to that church, and he was speaking prophetically at that time because that church was going to be on down the line from the time that he was speaking this to the Apostle John. He said, you're a dead church. He was prophesying that this church was going to be a dead church. Be watchful, he says, strengthen the things that remain, which are ready to die. I have not found your works perfect before God. You have a few names. Even in Sardis. I mean, that's kind of like saying, this is the bottom of the barrel. But nevertheless, even on the bottom of the barrel, there are some which have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy. See, so I'm confident that even though we don't have this information, and it's not impossible for us to have salvation without it. Proverbs 29 and verse 18. Here's something that is written in the Proverbs. If it be Solomon's proverb or not, I'm not sure. And Proverbs 29 and verse 18, where there is no vision, the people perish. He that keeps the law, happy is he. Why does it say that? I would surmise that it says the law provides vision. But we also may find there is quite a bit of vision in what results from the information in this paper. I would submit to you that there is. And understanding this information, why is it important? Is it important for salvation? I think there are plenty of counterexamples of people who will receive salvation without having properly understood this information. Nevertheless, I think it will provide vision for you, and vision is an important factor in not perishing, which, of course, I'm not anticipating that any of us will do, but nevertheless, We ought to prepare ourselves with as much vision as we can. There is a time, according to the Bible, in which knowledge would increase. You know, up until 100 years ago, maybe 300 or 400 years ago, knowledge was essentially completely lost from the time period immediately following the death of Christ. You know, within 200 years after the death of Christ, knowledge really began to be lost. Then came the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, and knowledge was completely lost. And we came into the 1930s, and nobody that we knew of, I'm confident some people were, but nobody that we knew of were keeping God's holy days, understood or were keeping God's holy days. And Mr. Armstrong had to go through a restoration in that regard. And I would say that's another reason why we ought to study this, is because the Bible has prophesied there would be an increase in knowledge in this age. Daniel chapter 12, verse 4. Daniel is instructed that what he has seen and he has been told to write about is not going to be understood at his time. And it's not going to be understood, as this prophecy says, all the way until the end of the age. You, O Daniel, what the angel is saying to Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and at that time of the end, knowledge shall be increased. And we've seen that, haven't we? Our knowledge, not only the knowledge that is being understood in electronics and in science in general, and things like astronomy and physical sciences in the world around us, but also biblical knowledge, spiritual truth, has been restored dramatically in the last 100 years. And we have tools to work with now. One of the big reasons is we have tools to work with now that have not been available throughout the ages from the time of Daniel until now. Yeah. Just having a Bible, that is a tremendous tool. Just the book available. And that wasn't even available generally until a certain period of time. Talk about that in a minute. But now, Jack's sitting over there with what? What's that you're sitting behind, Jack? No, not behind you. You're sitting behind. What is it? A computer. What a tool we have for understanding. How can we sort that Bible out and discover so many things that if we had to do it manually ourselves, It just would limit our ability extremely. But we have an incredible tool now for understanding. So that is sort of an implicit part of the fulfillment of this prophecy in Daniel 12. The time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Another reason why I feel that it's really important for us to have this information is because people died to be able to give it to us. A lot of people died so that they could bring this information down through the generations to us. Now, one of the people that I thought about in this regard is Tyndale. He was back around 1600. In Britain, and what did he do? In London, around London, he translated the Bible into English. It wasn't the first English Bible. The first one was translated by Wycliffe. I think Wycliffe was killed as a result of having done that too. And then Tyndale did a second English translation. And he was burned at the stake as a result of what he did. And, I mean, that makes me think, okay, it's not spiritually so important, but, I mean, if I respect the sacrifice that those people made in being able to get this to me, is it important for me to be diligent about trying to understand everything I can about it? That's just personal opinion. Tyndale is reputed to have made this statement. I'll read to you from a paper I copied off of the internet. If you want to get the address on the that you would enter on the address bar at the top, so you could read this. It's I have it here if you want it. Tyndale's Plowboy statement. Now he makes a statement about the Plowboy. A plowboy is somebody who's working the fields. And maybe at the time he's making that statement, plowboys did not read or write. And now a third of the people in our country, it's hard to believe, do not read or write. Tyndale's Plowboy statement is recounted in John Fox's Book of Martyrs. The context of the statement itself disproves the use to which modern translators put it. He's saying some things maybe that are not so important to us. Upon graduating from Oxford University, Tyndale returned to his native Gloucestershire and assumed a position as schoolmaster in the Catholic household of Sir John Walsh. Tyndale was an early reformer whose views brought him into heated debates with the local clergy. Tyndale was appalled at the ignorance of the Catholic clergy. Additionally, he was convinced of the Protestant doctrine of sola scriptura, does that mean solely by scripture. He would believe only that which he could be shown from the Bible. He was convinced of that. Luther is famous for making the statement about sola scriptura, solely by the scripture, on the question of religious authority. I assume these two things. I propose these two things, the biblical ignorance of the clergy and the question of biblical authority are the context for Tyndale's statement about the plowboy. We can hear these two themes in the biblical ignorance among the clergy and the authority of the Bible. So those two themes of Tyndale, biblical ignorance among the clergy at that time and the authority of the Bible. Tyndale happened to be in the company, it says, of a certain divine recounted for a learned man, and in communing and disputing with him might not have been exactly soft in his speech here. He drove him to that issue that the said great doctor burst out into these blasphemous words. We were better to be without God's law than the popes. So this renowned person made that statement. Master Tyndale, upon hearing this, full of godly zeal and not bearing that blasphemous saying, replied, I defy the pope and all his laws. If God spares me life ere many years, I will cause a boy that drives the plow to know more of the scriptures than he did, than the Pope. And that this was not well received. And one of the things that, Tyndale is famous for making this statement that he was going to make the average common person, the plow boy in the field, to know more of the scriptures than the Pope. How was he going to do that? He was working on the idea of putting the Bible into the language of the common man. The Bible at that point was legally only allowed to be in Latin. It was against the law to put it into the English language. So he died in part for that reason. And I think it's important if people died to get this information to us that we not take it lightly. Here's, I guess, last question on the notion of why. And I would say, it asks us, implied in the question that I was asked, will we be able to convert other people with this information? I mean, this is the conversion of other people, even that's God's job in the first place. But if we were to have the opportunity to work with somebody, are we going to do it? This is really complex, remote information that once you see it, it will enhance your understanding a lot. But this is not information that we're going to discuss with the general public. Okay, I would like to take a little bit of time here to talk about John's purpose in writing his gospel, because this all comes from the Gospel of John. In communicating, whether speaking or writing, organization defines that we put forth, demands rather, that we put forth our a statement about what it is that we're trying to accomplish. And when I'm giving the sermon, I'm trying to give you a specific purpose statement so you understand what it is I'm trying to get across to you. And in writing, anybody who writes something should give you a statement of purpose about what they're writing. Gospel of John has a specific purpose statement. Can you tell me where that statement is? Or what it is? Why did John write his gospel? Typically, a specific purpose statement comes at the beginning. Like I'm giving a sermon, I'm usually giving you the specific purpose statement at the beginning. Occasionally, specific purpose statement may come at the end of something. In this gospel, that's the case. The specific purpose statement for the Gospel of John comes at the end of the Gospel of John. John chapter 20 and verse 30 tells us what it is that John is trying to accomplish with his gospel. I think it's a very, very important piece of information to keep in our mind about what this whole gospel is trying to accomplish. And I think it bears importantly on this doctrinal paper and the result that flows from the doctrinal paper. John said, he's writing here and breaking into the context of what he says, many other signs, because he's written signs and signs that Jesus gave throughout the gospel here that he has recorded. Many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. Frank Duckel gave a seminar at the recent Winter Family Weekend. And he talked about those who are writing about history. Now, the Gospel of John is at least partly about the history of Christ's ministry, isn't it? And his seminar was entitled History and the Bible. One of the primary points that Frank Dunkel made about history and the Bible at that seminar is that a historian has to pick and choose what he's going to include in his history. Now here John is saying, I couldn't include everything. Many other signs did Jesus truly do in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. So I picked the ones I thought were the most important to you. Verse 31. These are written. The things that he did choose are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing, you might have life through his name. So he has specifically picked certain events. It says, so that you might believe. What would we call that? Faith. He wrote these things to build the things that he included in his gospel. He said he put them in there to build our faith, that you might believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing, you might have life through his name. It is as a result of believing that you may have life through his name. How would we support that statement? Well, Hebrews chapter 11 says what? Faith, you know, they've written these things that you might believe. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. For those that come to Him must believe that He is, He exists, even Satan knows that, and that He is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. So John is saying, if you look at that definition of faith that we just read in Hebrews chapter 11, John is saying these things were written so that you might believe in Jesus. So that's a pretty important reasons why we ought to pay maybe close attention to this. We have three other Gospels. They're called the Synoptic Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the Synoptic Gospels. John is the non-Synoptic Gospel. Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written much sooner after the death of Christ. After they were completed for some long time, John goes back and writes, when they say the others were synoptic and his was non-synoptic, they are saying, I'm not necessarily of this opinion, but they are saying that he has filled in those things which the others missed. I think it probably has much greater implication than that. But he says he is writing for a particular purpose, so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. Now he already no doubt had access to the other Gospels and had read them. So, statement here he's making is that all the knowledge of his gospel is intended to give you an increase in faith. I would like to say here to you that Gospel of John, when you get to chapters 7, 8, and 9, you know what I mean when I say something is telescoped, collapses, expands. Three chapters of the Gospel of John essentially are about one day in the life of Christ. So what he's saying is that one day, I would surmise he is saying that one day is very important to us in building our faith. Because he says what he's put in this gospel has to do with building our faith. And here he took three chapters of the book. I mean, events of several days leading up to this one day. But really, 7, 8, and 9 are all about the events of one day. I did the math on it. His ministry lasted for 1,277 days. John had 21 chapters in his book. But here are three of those chapters devoted to one day, focusing on one day. It may partly cover the other day. So that's really what I mean when I say it's telescoped. It's really focused on this one time. 1/7, you would say, the Gospel of John devoted to this time. And John no doubt thought those events and putting that much time, that much of his gospel into this time were really important to our faith. So let's take a little bit of time here. I'll try to go rapidly through this now because we've already been 40 minutes. Leading up to the day, starting in John chapter 7 and verse 1. This is, let me point it out to you, this is the last Feast of Tabernacles before Christ's crucifixion. Being the last day before his crucifixion, he knew about he was going to be crucified the coming spring. And so he's really intently thinking about what are the most important things to do here. John chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. He would not walk in Jewry, the place of the Jews, because the Jews sought to kill him. So Galilee was not heartland for the Jews. It was kind of a crossroads area where many people of different backgrounds came and went. That was where his family was from. He would not walk because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. His brethren therefore said to him, "Depart hence and go to Judea, that your disciples may also see the works that you do." So his brothers, now this is talking about, it isn't talking about church members. This is talking about members of his physical family. His brothers, the physical members of his family, were saying, "Go down to Judea so your disciples may see the work that you're doing. No man does anything in secret, and he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things," you know, it was kind of a stick in the eye, "if you do these things, show yourself to the world." For neither did his brothers believe in him. They didn't believe he, was anybody special. He was just one of their family. How can he be the Son of God? No, just one of the family. And Jesus said to them, "My time is not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that the works thereof are evil. Go you to the feast. I will not go to the feast, for my time is not yet fully come." Verse 9, he does go to the Feast of Tabernacles, but he just went clandestinely. He sneaked away to the Feast of Tabernacles and went without revealing who he was. Verse 9, when he had said these words unto them, he abode still in Galilee. When his brothers were gone up, he went up to the feast, not openly, but in secret. The Jews sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" Of course, his brothers, he's back in Galilee, he didn't come. There was much murmuring among the people concerning him, for some said, "He is a good man." Others said, "No, he deceives the people." But no man spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Then the rubber starts to hit the road here. About the middle of the feast, Christ went up into the temple and taught. And he offended the Pharisees. I'll drop down to verse 21. Jesus answered and said to them, "I have done one work, and you marvel." Now, I'm interested if I can figure out what work they're talking about that he did there at this Feast of Tabernacles. It doesn't really say here in the Gospel of John what work he had done, but apparently he had done some work at the middle of the Feast of Tabernacles. And there's some other interesting information here about that. "I've done one work and you all marvel. Moses gave you circumcision, and you," obviously the work that he had done was on a Sabbath day during the Feast of Tabernacles. "You on the Sabbath day circumcise a man. If a man on the Sabbath day receives circumcision that the law of Moses shouldn't be broken," it was the eighth day, circumcision under the law of Moses was to be done on the eighth day, "are you angry at me because I have made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day?" So here apparently at the Feast of Tabernacles on the Sabbath day, he had apparently doesn't really give the details, but apparently he had healed someone there. And they took great exception to it because he shouldn't have been healing on the Sabbath day. And you find that throughout the scriptures in a few places, don't you, where Christ healed on the Sabbath day. But here apparently is another case. He said, judge not according to appearances, but judge righteous judgment. Said some of them of Jerusalem. Isn't this that the man they're seeking to kill? But lo, he speaks boldly, and they don't say anything to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is the very Christ? Verse 30. They sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him because his hour was not yet come. Then here's the thing that gives rise to the question in the doctrinal paper. I'm getting close to the end of what I'm going to say here in this Bible study. John chapter 7 and verse 37. In the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. We've always understood that to be a prophetic statement. But we understood that prophecy to be about what we're now calling the eighth day, the day after the Feast of Tabernacles. But that's what this paper is establishing. That wasn't about the feast, that wasn't being said on the Feast of Tabernacles. That was being said on the seventh, I mean, it's not about the eighth day, it was being said on the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles. He that believes on me, as the scripture has said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. So the question is, which the doctrinal paper answers, we'll go through the doctrinal paper the next time, I hope without getting bogged down in it, because you can get bogged down with all of the information about all of the various things that all of the different rabbis have said about that. This pronouncement was being said on the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles, not on the eighth day festival. And if so, then, what does that say about the next day? That next day was High Holy Day, what we have always called in the past the Last Great Day, but it wasn't understood that these events were recurring. The events of John chapter 8 and John chapter 9 were recurring on the eighth day. And what I'm saying to you here is if those events are occurring on the eighth day, then they are prophetic events. They're not just to be regarded as occurring standard events of standard occurrence, but they are to be regarded in a different way. They are sanctified events, and they are prophetic events. That's why I feel the information is important for us to know and to understand. And I think it will, as John said in his gospel, be relevant to us in building our faith and helping us to grow in wisdom, grace, and knowledge. So I think it's consistent with the gospel, John's purpose in the gospel. John felt it was important in building faith. And so that's what I had planned to talk about today. And the next time I'll try to go through the doctrinal paper itself. So if you want to spend some time on that, don't get bogged down in it yourself. And don't get discouraged that it may be a little bit hard to understand, but you'll have some time to work on it because it'll probably be a month before I come back and go through that doctrinal paper. Okay. Thank you very much.